got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here as always. Kevin, how are you?
Awesome. Having fun.
I got to say, I'm excited to be here because my wife has decided to rewatch Glee for some reason. So all week I've been hearing teenagers sing Bohemian Rhapsody and I just want to slap myself.
Yeah, that's like, that's harsh. I'm really sorry to hear that.
Thank you. I appreciate your sensitivity in this time of difficulty. Anyways, science news. So we've got some very, very interesting and potentially troubling stories to talk about. So first up, gene editing could help farmers produce more beef from fewer cattle. Now, this, of course, means cheaper food and a cleaner environment. So this is good news for everybody. Anti-GMO groups have been very eager lately to sue as a way of getting pesticides and even GMO crops off the market. But it turns out this strategy might backfire and actually bring new technology to farmers. So we'll talk about that. And then finally, with more women working and having fewer children, there's a possibility that we're going to experience a major population decline by 2100 worldwide. So we're going to see how big of a problem this is and what we can do about it. And honestly, there may not be a great answer. So we'll explore that. But Kevin, let's talk about CRISPR gene editing and cheaper steaks, which I like.
Yeah, this is a really cool story. And this comes from Amy Quinton, who is a writer for University of California, Davis. And the story works from a bull named Cosmo. And Cosmo is a bull calf who's had his gene edited. Now, let me tell you about how this works. So we talk about heredity. And in mammals, when you are the mother, you can either give an X chromosome or an X chromosome, right? Only X. If you're the male, you can either pass a Y or an X. And if you pass an X, then that teams up with the mother's X and you get a female. If you pass the Y and it teams with the mother's X, you get a male, XY. So what is it about the Y that makes maleness? Well, it turns out there's a gene on the Y chromosome called SRY. And SRY is a what they call a transcription factor. It's a gene that makes a protein that goes and turns on a bunch of other genes. And so somewhere around 30 days after development, when you're just a little clump of cells, that gene turns on. And that gene then triggers a whole series of events to happen over the next months, maybe even years, that makes something male. And so this SRY gene, scientists have always wondered, is that by itself enough to make maleness? And so what this research team did, and this is with Allison Van Eenennaam and others at UC Davis, they took the SRY gene and moved it to chromosome 17, so a regular old chromosome. And what it means now is that you can be an XX cow, yet have this SRY gene on the chromosome 17, and will look like a male, and will develop like a male. Will have testes and do all the things that males do. So what this means in terms of genetics, and I know this gets a little bit in the weeds here, is if you're a bull that is XY, and you have this other chromosome 17 locus, this other gene that's been inserted. What this means is 50% of the time you're going to give rise to males because you give the Y chromosome. 50% of the time, 25% of the time, you're going to give an X chromosome. Wait a minute. Yeah, the other half. You're going to give an X chromosome that'll team up with the mother's X, but sometimes you're going to give an X that's going to team with this SRY gene. And that means you're going to give rise to 75% males in the next generation.
Okay, so big picture, these edited bulls, they convert feed into weight much more efficiently than a typical female cow would. And so the significance then is that you can get more meat, but they grow faster effectively. Is that what's happening? And then that's what enables all these environmental benefits later down the line?
That's right. It's called the conversion ratio. It's the way in which animals convert feed calories into final product. And so, you know, chicken and fish are more efficient than beef, but males are more efficient than females by about 15%. So more beef with the same input.
I gotcha. So it's a different technology, but would this sort of be like the GMO salmon that grows quicker, just to give people a comparison, something like that?
Well, the GMO salmon is every individual grows at a faster rate. Okay. This one is interesting because it produces, you know, instead of 50-50 males, females, it should produce 75% males, 25% females. So all it does is it skews that ratio in beef cattle to be able to produce more males on the field.
I got it. Okay. Well, and you know this too, Kevin, but the critics of this technology are going to say, well, this isn't really safe. And I think the way that they inserted, or the way they made this edit and where they put it, it's on chromosome 17, which they call a genomic safe harbor site. So what does that mean for anyone that doesn't know?
Yeah. So this area of the chromosome 17 in the bull, it's a place where there's a lot of real estate without any critical genes. And so you can drop genes into this space. They're well expressed, which is the other big issue. So you drop it into this area. They're well expressed. You don't have a likelihood of disrupting something else that's important. And it doesn't matter anyway, because this whole cow, this bull, will never go to market, you know, or any of its offspring, at least under the current regulations. But it's good proof of concept that it can be done and actually leads to more sustainable opportunities in beef cattle production.
Yeah, well, that's an important point too. And hopefully the FDA will look at developments like this and maybe change their minds. And for now, just for so people are aware, the FDA treats gene editing in animals like a veterinary drug, which are extremely difficult to get to market. And so it's a really strange concept, at least to me as a layperson. I don't understand why you would regulate an animal like a pharmaceutical.
Well, this is all it is a gene duplication. You're taking a gene that's in one part of the genome and now putting another copy of it somewhere else. You're not adding anything unusual. You're not changing anything from another species. You're taking that animal's own gene and making a copy of it somewhere else. And this happens actually in humans. There are in mice, there are what do they call translocations, where a piece of the Y chromosome breaks off and ends up somewhere else. Chromosomes are funny that way. They sometimes break and then reattach elsewhere. And the SRY gene has ended up on chromosomes, autosomes, so on the actual non-sex chromosomes. There are women on this planet who are XX, but have male characteristics. So you have male secondary sexual characteristics. You got all the hardware. You got some other things. You grow, you know, mustache and a beard. Yet you have 2X chromosomes that would indicate that you should be a female and you're sterile. So this happens occasionally. It's been documented. It's a natural process, something that could happen naturally, yet it's treated as a drug and probably can never be deregulated. In the U.S., in Brazil, they'll probably do it.
Yeah, that's a good point, Brazil. And I think a few other South American countries are a little more liberal on this question, which is good. At least someone's doing it. But while we wait for the FDA to shape up, let's talk about some other sustainability advances in farming, Kevin.
Well, I should ask you about this because this is your article. But it was called Sustainable Farming Practices, Global Movement to Ban Pesticides and GMOs Spur Next Generation Biotech Pest Controls. And, you know, you made a really nice point in this article. This was published in GLP. You made some really good points about how there has been such a vigorous effort to take out the progression of the new technologies. So give us a few examples.
Right, right. Well, I think the overarching point, and it's sort of an economics argument, which is something we talk about on the show sometimes, it's that when you pressure these companies through lawsuits, which is typically how these groups are trying to ban pesticides these days, you incentivize them to develop newer technologies that are harder to ban or harder to sue off the market. And so one of my favorite examples from the story, and you can dive into the finer details of this better than I can, Kevin, but some of these companies are working on technologies that can reverse herbicide resistance in resistant weed populations. And that's a major issue because these groups almost always, when they go to court or when they write an article in a major news outlet, they talk about super weeds and they talk about herbicide resistance as this mechanism that pushes use of more and more chemicals. And they call it the pesticide treadmill. Now, I believe they're exaggerating the problem. It's a real problem, but they are turning it into sort of a marketing thing for them. But nonetheless, this technology, when it becomes available, will make a lot of herbicides that farmers use effective against weeds that they're not effective against right now. And so that's just one example of this phenomenon where these groups are pushing themselves into irrelevancy by exaggerating problems. And then the public picks up on it and they goes, hey, we want sustainable farming. And the companies respond. They say, okay, all right, we're working on it.
Yeah, one of the most important things that you put in this article, one of the lines that really resonated with me was that the more chemistries and more options you take away from a farmer, the more likely you are to develop an opportunity for resistance, right? You're taking tools from their toolbox.
Right. And it's funny. And I believe I emailed you about that because I was reading a press release from, I think it was Pesticide Action Network, because they're one of the groups that are frequently involved in these lawsuits. And people have heard it's probably herbicides like dicamba, glyphosate, we've talked about on the show. And then there's some other herbicides that are sold and developed by other biotech companies. And so the idea is you sue and you get the pesticide off the market and the farmers don't want to grow the herbicide resistant seed. So it's a very clever legal strategy. But the point is exactly what you said is, you know, if you're concerned about resistance, then you don't want to ban chemicals. You want more on the market so farmers have more options that they can integrate into their weed control programs. And so the cynical part of me goes, they probably have to know this. These are smart people that are pushing these lawsuits. And so, you know, part of me says, well, they're doing this because they want more organic farming. But I don't want to speculate too much on that.
Well, I think you're exactly right. If you look at the history of these groups, but it really is by an analogy saying, we want to ban razors. So we're going to show you the razor blades are too sharp and they're going to hurt you. And they take a potential hazard, make it into a false risk, a manufactured risk to get rid of the original product. And that's been something they've been at for eons. This is Pesticide Action Network, Center for Food Safety. You know, there's a whole bunch of different groups here that they're not scientists, they're lawyers. Andrew Kimbrell and those folks. And this is what they do. They sue their way into changing the availability of technology. The problem is, or well, the good part is that you got an awful lot of scientists making new technology that's just going to, in the absence of good solutions, they're going to develop new solutions. So it's more like the lawsuit treadmill that they're going to have to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to stress, lawsuits aren't good. I mean, these are incredibly expensive. You know, all the millions of dollars you have to spend on attorneys and going to court and in some cases paying damages, that's all money that doesn't go into R&D. Because again, Kevin, you can speak to this too. The bulk of these companies' revenue, they reinvest into their R&D because they have to keep developing products because farmers want better tools. So it's not good that these lawsuits are constantly coming. The point is that there's a bit of a silver lining that incentives matter, again, to that economics point. People respond when you sue them, and this is a long-term strategy, I would say, to getting around them.
No, you're exactly right. And the other big part of this is that the lawsuits, they tarnish public perception. I mean, look what they did to glyphosate. You know, the safest agricultural drug or compound that you can think of, that because of, having it smeared all over the internet and all over television saying it causes cancer, which is what they said, even though there's no evidence of that, if the average person thinks twice about buying Roundup, and that is what they want to do. So it's a very good strategy to kind of just muddy the waters, in addition to potentially take a product off the market.
Absolutely. One final point I'll make is that there are all sorts of biopesticides being developed now, and these are crop protection products that are derived from microbes or derived from plants themselves. And so these are, in many cases, they're very effective. They're probably almost as effective as their synthetic counterparts, but they can kill glyphosate-resistant weeds or dicamba-resistant weeds. And there's one in particular that's being evaluated by the EPA right now, and it's showing good results in field trials. And it's developed by a company just down the street from me in Davis, where UC Davis is. And so that's particularly interesting because that one will be able to be used in organic agriculture. And so I find it highly unlikely that Center for Food Safety or Pesticide Action Network, none of these groups are going to be able to sue the maker of a biopesticide because all of their standard objections don't apply.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I know we've been working on some things too that have been really cool with tremendous promise, and lots of others too. There's folks who have been using RNA on tiny clay pellets and bombarding plants with them. There's so many new strategies coming for managing weeds, and hopefully we'll be able to come up with so many of them they can't sue their way out of it.
Very, very exciting. All that to say, you know, innovation finds a way, which I'm encouraged by. But let's move on to this next story, Kevin. I think this is probably the most significant and probably the most troubling. And so we're talking about birth rates crashing. So tell us about this story.
Well, it's a really interesting good news, bad news story. and that's why I found it so attractive. So they say that fertility rate is falling. And that's not like, you know, sperm count and, you know, number of eggs and all that stuff. That's the number of children being born. And in any context, if the birth rate falls below 2.1, then it means that the number of births the population is going down if it's below 2.1. And you'd think, why not two, you know, a mother and a father? It's because there are more male babies born and not every baby makes it to reproductive age. So if it's below 2.1, it falls. Now, in 1950, the average number of children per woman was 4.7. That's hard to believe, but 4.7. And and then in 2017, and this is global, 2.4. And what they guess is that in within the next century, it should be 1.7. So we're going to be in negative population growth pretty soon. And you know, that's bad news in a way. It really is kind of good news because I've said for a long time, with more technology and with people being fed and educated and access to medical care, it means that they're not going to be having as many children. So in a way, it's a success story that we have the luxury of a lower population. You see where that's going?
Yeah, definitely. And one point I'll stress, just to build on what you're saying, is that this idea of a population bomb or overpopulation, and that biologists like Paul Ehrlich pushed in the 1970s and 80s, you know, we're going to run out of food and we're going to run out of resources because there's too many people and we got to cap the global population somehow. That's clearly a myth. And I think people were saying that when he was writing his book and when he was writing commentary, they were saying, look, you don't understand how an economy works and you don't understand how people adapt. But I think this very, very starkly confirms what they were saying. You know, the global population is declining. So that's the good news, but I'm troubled by the other part of this, which is in the next 100 or 200 years, we're going to have negative population growth, as you said, but we're going to have an older population as well. And so if you're not reproducing, if you're not bringing more young people into society to start families and produce all the stuff that everybody needs, you just have a bunch of old people that can't make anything and that need healthcare, you know? And so I don't know what the answer is, but I think, you know, it's helpful to be honest about the problem that at least our kids are going to face.
No, that's very true. And I'm going to be one of those old people. I'm going to want my stuff, you know, you know, I don't want to be, you know, I paid my dues, you know, I'm going to shake my cane at the sky and say, you know, I did paid my dues and I get some stuff, you know. It's actually kind of cool because when I turned 50, I looked for the things that I would get for free. And it is, other than an ARP card in the mail, there's not that much stuff. I get free coffee at Arby's between noon and three. Thanks a lot. You know, but it gets better as we go. We'll find out. The big problem is that when Social Security kicked in, and when that was started, you would retire at age 65 with the idea that you'd probably have a good chance of taking the dirt nap by age 67. And so you would only be paying a couple of years out of that system. But now that the retirement age has stayed the same, but people are getting older and older before they die and having larger healthcare costs. And now the average age for men is, what, 77, women is 80. It's only going up. And so the question now is really, will we be able to support financially a 65-year-old retirement age and a population with an inverted pyramid, right, where very few number of earners supporting a huge number of absorbers? And that's going to be the challenge going forward.
So one short-term possibility that the BBC mentions in this story is that you can incentivize people to have more kids. Because the only other option really would be to say, well, you know, we need fewer women working. And I don't think anyone is going to accept that these days, especially the women who are working, you know. So the only really realistic thing you could do is effectively pay people to have more children. But maybe in the long term, to bring it back to genetics, you know, some of these technologies we've talked about, like it wouldn't be just IVF, but it would be technologies that allow you to reproduce without having sex and without having to carry a child. I mean, these are farther away, but since we're talking on the scale of, you know, 200 to 300 years, maybe genetics offers some sort of solution. I don't know. I'm just sort of spitballing here.
No, that's an important point that we glossed over, is that the article really does attribute many of the changes in fertility rate to women having more successes in the workplace. And we've talked about this for a long time with respect to genetic engineering, especially in places where women do the majority of the work. On the African continent, the women are the hardcore farm workers. And in many cases, giving them opportunities to do other jobs or to not have to spend all their time in the field, it gives them more lateral opportunity better incentive to be able to go to school or take on other more jobs that they may find more meaningful. And so this has been a real plus in a lot of ways. Unfortunately, it affects the population growth. And the only places that look like they're really going to grow like crazy are India and Nigeria.
Yeah, so it is troubling. Maybe the way forward is what I see people my age doing, which is, you know, my wife and I both have careers, but we also want kids. And so we're learning to balance the two. So we're both working, but we're in the next year, so we're probably going to start a family. And so maybe that's what you have to do. You have to get more people to do that. I'm not sure how, but maybe some combination of technology and a change of incentives is what's going to fix this.
Yeah, that could do it. I mean, we look at what happened in China when they put in the one-child policy. That was a devastating event for their country because of what it did socially and also with population contraction. But, you know, we're in the same boat. You know, I'm a little bit older and never had kids. But, you know, my wife right now is a little younger than me, and she's pretty excited about that possibility. And I'm all for it. But, you know, it is... may or may not be likely, but we'll see what happens. And the problem is even if I have one, I have to have another 1.1 in order to keep the population from going down.
Well, you better start practicing.
Well, you know, I guess you could just borrow someone else's, and that's always pretty fun.
So you have experience with borrowing other people's kids? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. No, actually, we're always very happy to, you know, cause we live on the farm with chickens and ducks and birds and things. And so kids love coming here. So we have lots of friends who are happy to share their families with us. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. Way to put a good spin on that, on my dark joke.
Well, you know, in the days of, with all the discussion of weird trafficking and stuff, I figured I better put as much of a good spin on that as I could.
Well, tell us what's going on with Talking Biotech.
Oh yeah, this is great. This week coming up is a talk about prions. And if you don't know prions, you got to listen to this. These are infectious particles that are not alive. This is chemistry that jumps from one organism to another and eventually kills you of an unusually horrible neurodegenerative disease. It's the stuff that mad cow is made out of. And I speak with one of the experts about that. And last weekend's was about Cosmo the Bull over with Allison Van Eenennaam. So lots of good stuff at Talking Biotech.
Yeah. And by the way, if I can be a fanboy for a second, the episode with Toby Bradshaw from the University of Washington was incredible.
Yeah. Because
you're talking about activist groups firebombing what they thought was a GMO tree laboratory, and it turned out to be an ecology lab that was trying to protect endangered plants. So good work, guys.
Yeah, no, totally. That was a really good one to listen to. That was number 249, and I recommended listening because it shows how when you target somebody, you have to be careful of the collateral damage. The target suffered nothing. But rare collections were lost, rare books were lost, a beautiful facility that was paid for by donors was destroyed. You know, and it just goes to show you got to be careful. If you're ever going to firebomb someone, make sure you know what you're doing. It was a really awful story that showed the collateral damage of misplaced activism.
Yeah. You ever remember those, the more you know, those little spots that they used to do on ABC?
Sure.
Back in the day? They could do those, you know, like if you're going to firebomb somebody, make sure it's the right person. And then the more you know comes up.
Dum, 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 dum.
All right. I am done making stupid jokes for the week. Thank you guys so much for listening. Check us out on Twitter at Kevin Folta, at Cam J English. Spotify, iTunes, and we will see you next week.